On July 6th, the Dalai Lama will turn 80 years old. He's the spiritual leader of the Tibetan people and the de facto ambassador for Buddhism around the world. But over the years, he's become something even bigger, a global spiritual leader with a universal message: be kind and be happy. How can you not love someone like that? Plus, he radiates joy. I remember seeing him once in a crowded stadium. He was this tiny figure in crimson and gold robes, and when he giggled, the whole place broke up. And all of this despite what he's endured, life in exile and the loss of his country. So how did this one man turn an obscure Tibetan religion into a global philosophy that inspires millions? Steve Paulson turned to journalist and psychologist Daniel Goleman. He's been a friend of the Dalai Lama's for decades, and he's just come out with a new book called A Force for Good: The Dalai Lama's Vision for Our World.
Dan, the Dalai Lama has been in the public eye for so long that it's easy to forget how unusual a person he is on the global stage. Just the fact that he was for decades both the spiritual and the political leader of the Tibetan people. Can you put his life in some perspective?
Well, you know, he was reared for a very traditional role in an arch-traditional society pre-communist Tibet, which was in some ways very medieval. And it was a country that, like the Vatican, I suppose, it was run by a religious figure. When the communists invaded in the 50s, it became increasingly clear that they were going to not let Tibet continue to have its religious freedom or cultural freedom. He left in 59. He fled.
We should talk about the circumstances of his departure because it's a remarkable story. He was, what, 16 years old at the time?
No, he's 26.
Oh, 26 at the
time.
Yeah, okay.
But still, it looked as though the Chinese army was going to capture him. That was the imminent crisis. Communist Chinese soldiers had been taking over Tibet area by area, killing monks and killing officials, and he had been promised by Mao, whom he met personally, that he would be allowed to continue to have cultural freedom and religious freedom, and it was clear that this promise was betrayed. He left in the middle of the night disguised as a Tibetan guard, and he rode on horseback, and he crossed the Himalayas.
For 15 days, right?
15 days in the snow, freezing. I mean, it's extraordinary. And then came out in India, where he's lived ever since. And slowly he became the figure we know today. But you have to remember, this was 59. And he had no training, no preparation, no formal schooling, and had to pick this all up on his own. And I think today he's an unparalleled world figure. We don't have anyone like him.
Yeah. So today we have this image of the Dalai Lama as this very enlightened figure, this guy who meditates for hours every day, someone who has this remarkable equanimity. He never seems to get flustered about anything, even, you know, these difficult circumstances with the Chinese. Was he always this way?
No, and he'll be the first to tell you. You know, I interviewed him about his emotional life, so to speak. He says, when I was young, I got angry a lot, and now I don't. I have seen him get angry for about a minute. Maybe twice in the time I've known him. And he's pretty unflappable. Bad news, tragic news comes his way. He handles it, but he doesn't let him throw him off. And it is true that he meditates a lot. He spends 4 hours in the morning, gets up at 3:30, Steve. But
4 hours in the
morning? The secret is he goes to bed at 7.
Every night. I mean, he's got to be a busy guy with a lot of demands on
his time.
Well,
if you get up at 7 and you meditate for 4 hours, it gives you the rest of the day, which he uses quite well. And he travels the world. He also meditates an hour at night, by the way.
Wow.
So it's a five-hour practice.
And doesn't he fit in some listening to the BBC in the morning?
Well, he does break his morning routine. And it isn't all just meditations, various practices. I don't really know what. 5:30, breakfast, and the BBC. He's a very loyal listener. He keeps up on the news. And he meets world leaders, and he meets, you know, people who are impoverished in those same countries. He gathers information from everywhere, and I think it gives him a unique sense of our global predicament.
So how did he make this transformation from this tempestuous young man to the renowned figure that we see today, who is unflappable, basically.
Well, I think what's been a little secret weapon for him is that he's a lifelong learner. He loves to learn. When I met him in 84, he mentioned that he wanted to meet with scientists. And I've been involved in a series of rounds where he'll spend 5 days in intensive discussion on topics like quantum physics or emotions.
Why is he so interested in science?
Because he is a seeker of the truth, and he sees science as a very powerful avenue for finding out the nature of things, how things are. He has said that as a kid, he loved to tinker. There weren't many mechanical things in Lhasa in the 30s and 40s, and you know, when he was young. There were two cars. He took them apart and put them back together. There were watches. He was the watch fixer. He fixed the generator. He likes engineering. He loves science. It's like a lifelong passion of his.
Of course, it raises questions about whether there are any fundamental conflicts between Buddhism and science and modern science.
Actually, he sees them as totally aligned. It's two different paths to finding the truth, and he's very comfortable questioning anything about Buddhism that science disproves. He's right there. And yet he also sees the limits of science. There's no ethical dimension to science, for instance.
There are a few Buddhist beliefs, like reincarnation, that would seem to be alien from the scientific worldview.
Well, they're alien, but as he points out, science can neither prove nor disprove a theory like that.
Now, one of the things that I find so interesting about the Dalai Lama is how he connects contemplative practice with making the world a better place. He doesn't just meditate to relieve stress, for instance. I mean, there's compassion built into this contemplative practice. Could you explain
this? That's right. He sees compassion as being essential, but there's a prior step, which is managing our what he calls destructive emotions, anger, anxiety, jealousy, all of those, the things that throw us totally off balance. What he says is, if you can get calm and clear, you'll be able to take in the problem more fully, understand it more deeply, and respond more nimbly, more effectively. And he urges everyone to start inside but act outside, to adopt an attitude of compassion, which is caring about everyone, and then take it in the world, take it on the road. And he says the gap between rich and poor is a crime. We need to do something about the economy. But feeling empathy is not the same as being compassionate, as doing something. And he is emphatic that we all have something we could do to make the world a better place, and we should act now.
Well, it's interesting to hear you explain this, because the somewhat cynical take on the way some of these Eastern spiritual traditions have been brought to America is, you know, they've kind of lost their spiritual depth. I can feel better. You know, I can kind of relieve my stress. I can use yoga to develop more fitness. But to actually retain that ethical dimension is not obvious, actually, with a lot of these practices.
And I think that's why he's so strong about it. Because, you know, frankly, meditation has been brought to the West in a very pragmatic way, a very American way.
In a non-religious way, often.
And it's secularized, and it does benefit people. There's nothing wrong with that. But it turns out that's just the beginning. That's not the end, particularly from his point of view, because if you season that with compassion, then you're going to do something. You're going to help someone.
So why do you think the Dalai Lama has this different standing than any other world leader I can think of?
Well, I've been reflecting on this quite a bit. I've done a lot of looking at leadership. I've written about it over the years. And I realized one thing. You know, if you look at the head of a company like a CEO, or if you look at a politician, they're very short-sighted. They're interested in quarterly return, you know, or they're interested in the next election, which narrows their vision. But his view is panoramic. He has no organization. He has no official post. He, you know, is not beholden to anyone, but he genuinely cares about the world as a whole. This frees him to grapple with the biggest issues, you know, healing the planet, the rich-poor gap, having a compassionate economy, these issues, which are basically ignored by business leaders, by political leaders.
Now, you've said that he has this remarkable equanimity, but there have been maybe a couple of occasions when you've seen him flash anger very briefly. Have you ever seen him get flustered?
You know, I've never seen him get flustered. I have seen him get angry at someone for a particular reason. The next day, he said, you know, I really love that guy. And he makes a distinction, which I think is very helpful to all of us, between the actor and the act. What he gets angry at is the act, but he continues to love the person.
Although there might be some people, or there must have been some people that he's had to deal with regularly who are just not very nice people.
I would say that the Chinese government represents that because of the way they, you know, they torture, imprison Tibetans and so on. It's a dictatorship. And even there, I've asked him about that. He says, you know, I condemn the actions, but not the people who are doing it. He doesn't give up on people.
What's his position on China and Tibet?
Well, he feels that Tibet will be part of China. That's a political reality. But he really wants there to be freedom of religion. And he wants autonomy for the culture. And he also, I think, would favor a fairer shake for the Tibetans themselves. More and more Han Chinese are moving into Tibet and taking over the economy.
Now, the image that I've always had of the Chinese response to the Dalai Lama is they don't much like him. They see him as a thorn in their side, probably waiting for him to die so that they can take firmer control of the country. Is there any sense of negotiation there?
Well, the Dalai Lama's people have tried for decades to negotiate with China, but I don't think China's interested. I think they'd be smarter to deal with this Dalai Lama who wants to talk to them and wants to work out a way to live together while he's around, rather than just condemning him, which is what they seem to do.
Of course, the Dalai Lama is now entering his ninth decade. Presumably, he won't be around for that much longer. What's your guess as to what will happen in Tibet once he's no longer on the scene?
You know, he is 80, July 6th, and he seems to be in very good health, particularly for someone who's 80. He seems to like he'll be around for a while longer.
That's Daniel Goleman talking with Steve Paulson. Dan is the author of Emotional Intelligence and A Force for Good, The Dalai Lama's Vision for Our World.